for instance, CD101 mm-hmm. has a huge demographic as far as the listening. You know, they have a huge share as far as the number of people that tune in every day. They advertise on the television. You know, things like that. Jazz mm-hmm. Station, it advertises on the television. But, you know, it's weird. I'm in the business. I haven't done this in a long time, but if I were to turn on that station and listen to the people, I'd go, I never even heard any of these people. These are people, you know, they're selling albums like you can't believe because yeah. they got airplay on a station like this. But I don't even know who they are, and they never play.
Yeah.
They just make records.
Because I remember Les McCann telling me last week that he opened up for Kenny G.
Oh,
in
really?
Mexico in front of 9,000 people. Les McCann opening up for Kenny G.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it, but he said that that's the way the market's dictating things now. You know, you got, it's all money-based. And I guess you could tell me, Chico, that back in the 30s and 40s, it really wasn't so much money-based as it was music-based. People were probably out there making
the
music.
The 30s were a little before my time, but...
Sorry about that.
No, but the 40s, the 50s, it was a question of... it was no problem for the simple reason there was only one kind of music, you know, which they considered jazz, but it was swing music, you know, and there's only one groove, you know, other than the Dixieland style of music, you know, mm-hmm. two-beat kind of thing. But other than that, you know, you had the big bands, and everything was straight ahead, you know, straight ahead jazz and swing, you know, and so it wasn't a difficult thing to choose from. It's just a question of whose band or whose sound you like, you know. And then when it came into what, to the 50s, when the
R&B,
and then the see, that's another. I don't know who put the title, who put the name on that, you know, because what they considered R&B, that was just a form of swing music.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, here you go, you got R&B, what the hell is that, you know? It turned out to be rhythm and blues, right? Then from that, rock and roll, you know? So, I mean, country's always been country, at least, you know, it's always been identified. Plus the fact, Dixieland music has always been Dixieland kind of
right.
music, you know? So, as compared to what today is, who knows, you know, pop, all the titles that they got, I don't know what kind of, you know.
It's all a variation on a theme, though. Wouldn't you say so?
I wouldn't say it's a variation on a theme now. It's whatever anyone chooses to make it. You know, if you get the bucks to sell your wares, hey, that's what it is. You know, that kind of thing. It has nothing to do with talent, whether the music is good or whether it's bad or indifferent. It's just a question of, hey, man, you got enough money and you got a good enough sponsor. That's it.
You call it whatever you want to call it.
Exactly.
But you look, okay, I'm just thinking of back then you had clubs where musicians would play.
Oh, yeah.
And you had places like the Apollo Theater, vehicles for showcasing your talent.
Well, you also had, back then, you had agents who believed in their talent. An agent wouldn't sign you unless you did have talent in those days. You know, the Joe Glazers, the Shaws, and people like that. They wouldn't sign you up. Unless you did have talent, that you had an organization that was saying something. That's number one. And they took their talent and they developed it, helped to develop it, mature it, and booked it, you know, got work for it, and things like that. And you, in turn, if you became semi successful, you hired yourself a press agent. And from then on, you know, because once writers during that time. Funny thing about it's the media today, but writers then, you know, once if they said something good about you and you became successful, that was it. They wouldn't say anything else about you. No more rights, right, you know, unless you paid them, you know, that kind of thing. So during that period, man, you had guys like the guys who were band leaders helped to develop other younger players, you know. And young players had an opportunity to get experience by playing music, by making music with other bands. Today, it doesn't happen. totally impossible, you know?
So I think of people like Duke Ellington's band, who had incredible musicians, but Duke took the time to develop the sound and I guess the, you know, the different sections of his band, and you had people like John
Duke,
Hodges.
Duke Ellington was a master at being able to extract, at extractions, doing the, you know, having, putting the right person in the right place at the right time for all of his works, all of his compositions, all of his arrangements. He knew exactly, he knew the potential, the limits of each individual player, and he knew their sound. And whatever he had in mind, whenever he would write something, if he had that sound in mind, he had the man to do it, the player to do it.
I remember Buddy Rich saying that, now just to change the topic a bit, when you're drumming, you should be able to do with your right hand what you can do with your left hand, evenly matched.
That's the way that they used to teach you. They used to teach you that was the general rule, you know. Whatever you do with your left hand, you're supposed to be able to do with your right, and vice versa, which is.
But you look at someone like Chick Webb, or even Horace Parlin, who played piano, who had so-called disability, but sort of extracted whatever he can out of, based on whatever.
Well, you know, you take an instrumentalist, anybody, any player, whatever's right for you, you know, because, you know, you might have 3 teeth and 6 noses and 10 ears, you know, and so you get an instrument that has 6 notes and 10 holes, and you know, so anything's fair as long as you can make music out of it. You know, if you get the sound that you want, and you, and it's playable, and you're playing it, so whatever it takes, you know.
Yeah.
There's advantages and disadvantages of learning an instrument correctly and incorrectly. So, but this is like anything else. This is like life.
Do you find that there's too much emphasis placed on technique now, as opposed to raw emotion?
Well, technique in regards to what?
Playing style. As you're playing, what I'm thinking of is people that are coming out of the schools now instead of coming out of the clubs, coming out of the streets, where they don't, getting back to the importance of playing in clubs and getting to meet different people.
Well, coming out of the schools, there's a lot to be undone that the average young player soon realizes. That, hey, what I learned in school is just going to take me just so far. And it's not really like the way it is, because it has nothing to do with human emotions. What you learn in school for as the jazz aspect is concerned, because unfortunately, most jazz instructors in schools are so one-dimensional, you know. It's either the Stan Kenton form or style, or either the,
Fletcher Henderson style.
You know, all of that, you know. There's nothing wrong with them reverting back to history, you know, as far as the beginning of what jazz was all about. And it's no secret that black people invented jazz, you know, it's no secret. So, but getting into from the jazz aspect into just music in general, then that, you know, it becomes something else. So it's like you said, there's no joints, so okay, that's a world of experience that, you know. Now, whether you need this or not, who knows? It's just a question of being in what kind of environment you're in, you know, what kind, how you surround yourself, who you're surrounding yourself with, you know. Because if a young guy, like for instance, if a guy comes on my band, right, and I can see and hear the potential. If he doesn't have the potential, he wouldn't be on my band in the first place. That's number one. And having come on the band, I give him every opportunity in the world to develop and sort of guide him in regards to sort of help him become total musically, not just one directional kind of thing. And the best foundation in the world for anybody, man, is to have a solid rhythm section behind you. So
Yeah, I think of Wynton Marsalis saying a few years ago, I remember him saying that he learned more in a week playing with Blakey than the 4 years he did at Juilliard or wherever he went to school. And there again, the importance of actually gaining that valuable experience of playing on the road and playing with different musicians and just that whole communication thing that you don't get in the classroom or in the sterile environment.
What do you think of Wynton Marsalis? You frown.
I like
Have you seen the new Downbeat?
No.
With Lester Bowie on the cover?
I got the one with Brantford.
Yeah, it's the last one.
The one? Yeah, got that one.
Lester has some pertinent comments in reference to Senor Wynton.
Oh, see, the thing I wish, I don't know if it's just me, but I wish that he'd undo his tie a little bit and sort of get looser in his playing and more wide-ranging in his...
I think that's impossible for him.
Yeah.
You know, he's strangely, not only enough, he's very one-directional.
Mm-hmm.
He's instead in what's gone by in the past,
mm-hmm.
Which to me is leaves him totally uncreative, unimaginative. So,
I think of people like Miles, who went in all kinds of directions, but fostered that breathing ground for musicians to just keep their ears open.
There's no comparison of Miles to Wynton Marsalis. Wynton Marsalis, he lived to be 139 years old. Yeah. He would never be a Miles Davis. You know,
yeah.
I mean, come on, you know,
yeah.
You know, that's bullshit. You know, and. Miles Davis was a sound. Miles was a movement. Miles was stone cold emotional. Miles was, he was only one.
Mm.
He was only one Miles Davis.
Yeah.
Just like there was only one Duke Ellington. Yeah? One Count Basie. One Lester Young. One Charlie Parker.
One Chico
Hamilton.
Definitely.
One Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah.
You know? There's all. You know, it's I don't know why these ones are ones. It's just like I have never tried to be like anyone else, or tried to play like anyone else. You know, I found out very early in my career, I mean, in my playing, that shit, it was totally impossible for me to play like Joe Jones or Sonny. You know, so I had to go for myself. You know. Had to make my own waves, you know, that kind of thing.
I think the first time I heard you was on the Passing Through album, but a little later on, what really knocked me out were the sessions you did with Jerry Mulligan in the 50s. It's re-released on Mosaic. Those are killers.
That was, to me, the bottom line, all the BS about the mystique of the Jerry Mulligan quartet, is that we just happen to be four people, four guys at the right place at the right time. Believe me, that's the bottom line to it. Because it's Jerry was talent, Chet Baker was a talent, Bob Whitlock was a talent. I was a talent, and we came about it in a funny kind of way. First thing we did, you know, first time we played, hey, it happened. And that's the way it goes. That's what happens with that. It's just, I've had that happen to me. I've been very fortunate because the first trio record I did with George Duvivier and Howard Roberts, that was a happening. The first quintet record I did with Fred Katz, Buddy Collette, Jim Hall, myself, Carson Smith, that was a happening. The quartet I had with Gabor Szabo and Charles Lloyd, Albert Stenson, that was a happening. You know, I got a happening right now, man, with this group, with this quartet. This is a happening. This is a happening.
You've got quite a band.
Yep.
This is with
Eric Person, Cara DeNiglis, and Reggie Washington. This is a happening.
On your album Arroyo.
Yeah.
I was struck by the arrangement of Alone Together.
Yeah.
The first time I heard it, I didn't really like it, but the more I listened to it, that guitar sound, was that planned ahead of time, that sound that Gary got on his...
We just did it.
Just, was great.
Matter of fact, we're going to do it tonight.
Just for you.
Yeah, we'll do it tonight. But that's another thing that we, you know, that we do, that we take the, when we do standards from yesteryear, try to put a contemporary approach to them. So, you know, I just try to stay contemporary, you know?
I noticed that in your drum patterns at the beginning of Alone Together.
Yeah.
It's not that conservative sort of beat that we've heard, especially with that standard. Yours is a more of a funkified rhythm that just breaks
down. Well, I'm really a little funky player, right?
But the thing I like, though, is the possibilities that you're exploring in that piece.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the thing that I liked about those sessions you made with Mulligan and with Gabor.
We take it through all the changes, man. You know, see, musically, the only thing that you can do that's going to be different, you know, is a rhythm pattern. The melodic structure, hey, it's there. It's always been there. You know, that kind of thing. And the only thing that's going to change it, be changed, or you can say, hey, it's going to be different, is that you have a different rhythm pattern. Other than that, it's going to be the same. You know, La Mam shows, right?
Yeah, it's pretty, and your trio album that you made recently, that was about 91?
Well, it just came out, we did it last year, 92.
Was that 92?
That's, when you get into that, when you really get into it, you realize, hey, there's no bass. All of a sudden you realize that it's just a guitar and a drum and a horn, and you're going to say, all of a sudden you say, damn, this is a hell of a lot of music coming out of these big guys, man. No overdubbing, no... this is just live performances. You're going to say, wow, because we take you on a trip. Take you on a musical journey, you know, which is what music is supposed to be about anyway, you know?
Well, it's funny because yesterday I was watching a movie that they did on Benny Carter, and he was playing a performance, I think it was in New York City, and he holds up his trumpet, and he's looking inside trying to find that note that he's been searching for, and that's basically what it's all about. I guess they just had searching all the time for different possibilities, different things that can happen at any one given moment in time.
The acceptance of innovative people musically has always been a little difficult.
I agree with you.
You know, I've been standing in line for a long time. you win some and you lose some, that kind of thing. But I tell you, my reward is the fact that, like, I'm still looking, I'm still searching, I'm still trying to do, I'm trying to do good. I'm trying to be good at what I do, you know?
No, seriously. Yeah.
And when you got to, you know, when you're your own person, it's not easy. You know, because of having the acceptance, you know, because a lot of times, you know, you get your feelings hurt. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's all we're dealing with is human emotion, spirit, you know, because of the nature of the beast, which is, hey, music, right? And the way people listen, you can't tell anyone how to listen.
Yeah, it's one thing that they can't teach.
And overall, I feel as though the greatest musicians in the world are the listeners. Not the people who make it, but people who listen to it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, Little Jimmy Scott.
The singer?
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's...
Hey, man, he's been out here 1,000 years, too. Yeah.
And that's the exact same thing that he was telling me. He's been off the scene for, 35 years. Now he's slowly making a comeback, whatever a comeback is. And it's been rough on him. He's been screwed by Savoy and record companies.
That's the nature of the beast today, man. Things along those lines haven't changed, man. People got screwed back there in the early days. They got screwed in the middle days, and they'd be screwed in the future days, man. You know, as far as that's concerned. You know, it's because the artist, what he's doing is more important to him than the financial aspect, I suppose, you know, in regards to the benefits that can be reaped, you know.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you got people who, hey, if they're in management, if they're in the business, that's their nature to be. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. You know, if they have to do a little zing here, a little zing there, that's what they do. That's how they make it. So, you know, nobody's going to change. Nothing has changed.
Yeah.
You know, and you got people in this business now that, needless to say, that control. I mean, they have total control now.
Big Brother.
Yeah, total control. Yeah. And here again, a talent doesn't have to have any talent.
Just the smarts.
You know?
Yeah.
You don't have to have any talent, man, to become a, I won't say a star, but a big name like that, you know. They've taken it, the whole thing context out of what the hell is a star. These people, the general public thinks because somebody makes a movie that they're movie stars. They're no fucking stars, man.
That's right.
You know?
I remember Jackie McLean going to Japan a few years ago, and when he got off the plane, there was a red carpet on the airport, and he thought that there was some kind of royalty on the flight, but he saw these big banners up all over the place, "Welcome to Japan, Jackie McLean." Now, would you ever see that in Boston?
Hey, man, listen, I had the same thing happen to me in Japan. First time I went to Japan, it was unbelievable. Un-fucking believable. And I got off the plane. For some unknown reason, man, I got off the plane in front of my wife, which is, and that's the procedure, right? I didn't, had no idea. And I looked, I was standing at the door, and they must have had at least 200,000 people at the airport, flight, everything, right? This is the truth. I took to my wife, I said, damn, somebody important must be on this plane. Really, you know, I had no idea that it was for me, man. And not strangely, but the first thing they asked me when we got to the airport, Miles, they wanted to know if I had a message. Because Art Blakely was just there, and the message just, now I got no goddamn message. It was funny, man. This was in 1962.
They're nuts over there in Japan.
They've changed some, man, because they've become so Americanized, you know. Yeah, hey, man, they're rich. Mm. You know, and becoming blasé about it.
Yeah.
You know, just like everything else.
But they always seem to do things right. I remember picking up a Billie Holiday set that was released on Japanese Verve. And it was in chronological order, and it was, you know, nicely presented.
Mm-hmm.
The American companies never seem to be able to do that right.
Well, that's because they don't know anything about the music. I mean,
exactly.
There's a couple of things that I could tell you about. I mean, first of all, I forget this cat's name, but the cat that's president of NARIS, which is the National Recording Society. They're the people who give out the Grammys every year. And I think it was about 2 years ago, I turned it on only because of the fact I knew that they were supposed to give Coltrane not a lifetime achievement, but you know, whatever it is, recognizing his career. And I remember it was Coltrane was one of the recipients, Muddy Waters, and then there was some other guy, I forget who. And you know, here's this guy, very powerful guy, Michael something or other, I forget his name exactly. I mean, the Grammy, the National Association of Recording Science, you know, it's a big deal. And, you know, the way they do it is he makes a little speech presentation while they're showing a video, the Coltrane, you know, some footage. And what he was reading had, like, no relationship to anything about John Coltrane. You know, so they don't know anything about it. Another thing that I've heard in reference to Coltrane is that whether it was ABC or MCA or whatever, they actually supposedly have thrown away some of the masters, you know, because they ran out of room in the vault.
You think Bob Dylan would have some?
Bob Dylan definitely has.
Bob Dylan has them.
Has some of everything.
Bob Dylan has some of everybody's, man. He's...
These are people.
Mystery man.
These are people who don't know anything about what they're dealing with.
And it's sad because when you look back, it's not done properly. And I mean, jazz is an American art form. And if you go to Vienna and you see the way that the Viennese treat classical musicians over there,
yeah.
they've got these amazing shrines. You don't have that. Well, at least I don't think you have that here. I've never seen it. But if
it, not yet. Not yet.
I would hope it's going to be coming
not
soon.
Yet.
Long overdue.
Not yet. Is Canada going to build a statue for Oscar Peterson?
I hope so. I mean, he was presented with an award.
Yeah, just a little while ago. Was it in Montreal? Or?
It was in Toronto.
Yeah.
And
Benny Green was there too.
Yeah, he was playing with him. The amazing thing was that he was presented the award on Monday and he had a mild stroke over the weekend.
Oh, really?
So he was playing with basically one hand and I was listening to it on the radio and I couldn't tell. You know, I remember a session that Albert Ammons did once in the 30s, I think it was, and he was playing with a stroke. Absolutely incredible. You know, when you're gifted, you're gifted, and I guess you just take all the possibilities you can. When did you first start getting into music?
The day I was born, I guess.
Yeah.
Before I was born,
sounds
I guess.
Like
who knows? I don't know, at a very early age.
Was it something you heard on the radio, or?
No, not necessarily. I got involved with music because my best friend had a clarinet, and you know, I was about 8 or 9 years old, 7 or 8, I don't know. And at the school I went to, the grade school I went to, you had to every student had to take some form of music, whether it was music appreciation, learning an instrument or something. I was in California, and Los Angeles. School system required all students to have music at one time or another, you know, within the first 6 years, I guess, you know. And the fact that he was my best friend, you know, then I got a, you know, clarinet and left this clarinet and went to drums, you know. And I began to dig it, you know. At first I was just doing it. And then, you know, little by little, I was mainly self-taught musician, and very fortunate to be able to be to have played with and learned from, you know, the ones, the originals,
like Chick Webb and
well, not so much Chick Webb, but Joe Jones, Sonny Greer, you know, and Lester Young, and people like that who I played with, you know, and. These are the ones that I learned from. Mm. I wasn't so much a Chick Webb fan, but you know, I was aware of him. But I was born and grew up on the West Coast. Chick Webb was on the East Coast, you know, New York.
Yeah, I remember when I spoke to Les McCann, we talked a lot about Carl Perkins.
Carl?
Was that?
Yeah. Carl was something else, man.
And then I mentioned one name and he almost fell off the bed. I mentioned Hampton Hawes and he said, "Oh yeah."
When I came out of the service in 45, Hampton had come up in those years, I guess the early 40s, I met him and heard him, you know, and because he was just a young dude, you know, when I got drafted, whether he was playing or not, I don't know, you know. But Hamp was some kind of player, man.
There were a lot of really good musicians from the West Coast. Yeah. Of course, my favorite tenor sax player was Dexter Gordon. And
well, Dex and I went to school together. We went to grade school. You know, Dexter was one of those. Dexter and Buddy Collette, Mingus. We all grew up together. We all had, you know, we had a little band around L.A. Illinois, Jack Hatt, Ernie Royal.
And Marshall?
Marshall was a little older. Marshall was already a pro, you know. Yeah, he used to...
Established,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was established. Marshall used to kick my ass, man. You know, if any of us got out of line, you know, he kept us straight.
Yeah, I like the the picture of the drum set that you played on those sessions with Jerry Mulligan, you had a little, looked like a little conga in the middle, and you had just a snare and a bass. It was very simple, maybe one cymbal. You didn't have a ream of tom-toms like Billy Cobham has, or...
You know, it was... Jerry had a thing about bass drums. And I, you know, and I went along with the program for a while, and then all of a sudden I said, hey man, I gotta have me my bass drum. Yeah.
How are you today?
Yeah, I use 16 inch.
And you play Gretsch exclusively?
No, man, no. I got a, I guess you would call it a bastard set.
Mixed and
matched. Yeah, just one of these and one of those. And
okay.
One of these, one of those. Whatever I like, you know, I just put it all together.
Okay, great.
And make noise.
So that's
it.
We'll do the sound check immediately before our show.
So, it's like...
All right, we'll be leaving here at 7:30.
The instrument has something to do with it, but it's the player.
That's right.
You know, and to me, the most important thing is the cymbals.
That sounds good, man. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Got cymbals according to your ear, you know. We cool?
Yeah. They're going to put off the sound check until before the show.
Oh, okay.
And we'll go over, I think, at 7:30 or something.
All right. That's cool.
What kind of cymbals do you use? What kind of cymbals do you play?
I got Zildjians. Man, you know, I got a cymbal that's shit. That cymbal's got to be maybe 60, 70 years old that I'm playing on, 20 inch. And I went to the vault in Boston, Zildjian company, and in that vault, man, they must have at least 20,000 cymbals. Believe me. The third pair that I picked out, I still got them. It was my sock cymbal. For my sock cymbal, that was it. I just picked out, you know, one, two, and then the third pair that I fooled with, hey, that's it. Anyway, you know. That's the way I am about music. I mean, about playing. If I played something, man, I've had it. Let me, you know, let's go into something else, you know, that kind of thing.
Something different.
Yeah, I try to get into something different because, man, you know, it takes a long time to do something different. A long time, you know, because you can't be creative all the time. You can't... music can be boring, too, you know.
Can be boring?
Boring.
I've never found that.
Well, it all depends, you know, especially drum solos can be really boring, you know. And...
I'm a drummer, that's why I say no.
Well, you... there's just so many patterns.
Yeah.
And you know what they are. And you get caught up in them, and you play them repeatedly. And, you know, I said, you know, don't you ever say to yourself, damn, I want to do something different. I want to do something, you know. And maybe say you're playing 7 nights consistently, right? And the 7th night, for about 3 minutes, you do something different, and that makes you weak. You know, that's it.
I always enjoy listening to Max Roach because it's like he's telling a story on his...
Well, not only Max, any drummer. I'm impressed with anybody that tries to play. Really, seriously. And some players are more matured than others. You know what I mean? Some players are more developed than others. Yeah. Always listen to... I don't particularly listen to so much what a guy's doing, playing. I listen to what kind of sound, you know, what kind of sounds coming out of the instrument, you know? Because the only way you can get a sound is by acquiring a touch.
That's one thing I liked about Coltrane. His sound was just, you know, using one example.
Well, that's the dynamite thing about it. People like Coltrane, like Byrd, like press, like this. You hear them, you know who they are. You know? You know who Max is. You know who Alvin is. All you gotta do is have Alvin. You hear Max, right? At one time, you heard Buddy. You knew who Buddy Rich was.
Art Taylor?
Art Taylor, you can't... No, I wouldn't put Art... I would maybe Art Blakely.
Because I can always tell when Art Taylor's...
Well, see, you can tell. But I'm speaking of in general. People that listen right. In general, they couldn't tell. All they know is that, hey, this is a hell of a drummer. This guy's clean, he's fast, he's cool. But they don't know who it is. He could be Roy Haynes. He could be several other people. You understand what I'm saying? But hey, when you heard Joe Jones, you knew it was Joe Jones.
Definitely. Or even Louis Belson.
Yeah. Well, Louis.
I mean,
between Louis and Buddy, the styles were very similar in regards to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Buddy, you can tell just like that.
Yeah. You know. So that's what I'm saying. When you got. Guys who are individuals who got this, who got the sound, their sound.
Very important.
Yeah.
Another thing I've been noticing is that a lot of musicians are going back to creating their own record companies. Yusef Lateef has his own label now. Roland Vasquez out of New York.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Jeff would know more about that than I would. Yeah, I don't know whether that's a losing proposition or not.
Well, I think what when he had his own label, I mean, it didn't last very long, and he had a lot of problems with it, but was that a cry to try and take control as a musician rather than let the big...
Well, you just... You know, the bottom line to the recording industry or the recording is the fact that, like, if you can't get any front money, forget it. Mm-hmm. You're not going to see any more money, you know? And you're gonna you live a life of wondering and waiting, you know, that kind of thing. And just, you know, when you're dealing with people, say like a Bob Thiel, for instance, every once in a while, every 3 or 4 years, Bob Thiel might release a record. And the people that are on the record are all dead. Mm-hmm. You know, there ain't nobody to pay no royalties to. Hey, that's the nature of the beast, right? So I don't know whether it's a good thing or whether it's the bad, you know. It takes a lot of money, man, to get involved with records.
Yeah.
Believe me, a lot of dough. And you have no guarantee you're going to get your dough back.
Yeah, that's, I guess.
And, you know, and the piracy thing is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unbelievable. Fucking Japanese they got it down, man, you know. The same thing in Europe, man. I have experienced a performance in Europe, and somebody's got a cassette and is selling me, hey, you know, hey, man, listen to this Chico Hamilton thing. I've seen more record covers, different covers of mine all over the world, man. It's, you know, it's amazing.
So you don't only get screwed by the record companies, but in a lot of ways you get screwed by the public.
That's right.
It's a double-edged sword. One thing I wanted to ask you was, when I was talking to Jimmy Scott, he mentioned, we were talking about the movie Bird, how we thought it was a very poor representation of Bird the musician.
It sucked, man. It's just like the Billie Holiday story sucked.
Yeah, but he mentioned, and I didn't know this, I don't know if you're aware of this, that Bird was a pharmacist? Told me that not too many people knew that he had some kind of a diploma, or he was a registered pharmacist.
I don't know, it could be another one of them bird stories, man. Hell if I know, man. I don't know, man.
I knew
Charlie. I knew Bird, and man, I guess he's got more stories out about him, man, than. He's a pretty funny guy, though, man. Bird was. Man, Bird.
Yeah.
He was nice to me, though.
Yeah?
Yeah, he was nice to me.
Did you ever play with him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a bit in California.
Oh, when he went over?
Yeah, when he was in California.
On the West Coast. Have you heard of Willis Kirk?
Willis Kirk. What does he play?
The drummer.
No.
On the West Coast. He used to play with Wes Montgomery for a while.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Hmm. Where? When they would?
I think it was in the 50s sometime.
Hmm.
And we were talking about you and...
Yeah. Well, let's see. If he was with Wes then, with the trio?
Yeah, it was with his brothers.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. In fact, in Downbeat, about 2 or 3 issues ago, there's a picture of them playing.
Oh, yeah?
He's got a book out on brushwork for drummers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be a real... long one. But we were talking about you and about... all the great drummers of days gone by and how they had their own style and their own voice. Because I find a lot of the drummers now just seem to be technique and that's it. They don't have any sound that you can say, yeah, that's...
Well, you know, I fault rock and roll for that.
Mm.
The rock and roll style of playing. Because it's so regimental in regards to the form and the style and the sound that it doesn't allow a drummer to really
cut loose and
do anything, you know. It doesn't allow you to become musical at all, you know. And in order to, a rock and roll group, I guess, to become successful or be successful, they have to play in one dimensional all the time. They have to play that one thing. Once you got that one beat, and if this is what the public bought, that's what you got to do. Subsequently, that puts the limitation on a guy's playing, you know. Mm-hmm. And plus the fact, goddamn engineers. Engineers have destroyed the drums, you know. Taping this, baffling that, you know. Engineers have forgotten. Engineers don't know what the true sound of a drum is.
Yeah, I'll give you an example of that.
You can give me an example.
Dave Brubeck, you listen to Joe Morello on take 5. There was a nice roundness to his bass and his toms and his snare. You can actually hear the drums. Same thing with Philly Joe on So What. You know, you can hear the sizzle of the cymbals, but now that's I don't know, it just seems to be missing.
Well, I got to say, man, I have an engineer. Jeff turned me on to this engineer, David...
Merrill.
Robert Merrill's son, you know, the officer, his son. This guy is an unbelievable, fantastic engineer far as the drums are concerned. Did you like the sound of those drums on the trio?
Yeah.
Those were the drums. Those were the natural sound of those drums.
Yeah, it was nice to hear that.
For a change, isn't
it?
The cymbals sound like cymbals, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's all. Yeah.
It seems like a lot of engineers make them tinny or something. Everything's missing. The tom-toms themselves sound like a thud rather than the resonance that's within that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's too bad because there's a lot of music that's just missing as a result of that. And kids are buying that.
That was something with Arroyo was done in a different kind of way, but we've done... The first session in a series of recordings that we've done in the last year was trio. And even though they were all done for soul note, I kind of independently put them together with my own engineer, my own studio, that kind of thing. And as far as the sonic aspect of it, you know, when we did Arroyo sounds good, but the one thing about me, about that record that bothered me was, even though you could hear the drums, you could hear everything, they don't seem to have the presence, you know? And that was the one thing that I wanted to fix with these new recordings that we did. And I don't know anything about the technical aspect of, you know, that the engineer does that. But particularly on the trio record where you have no bass, it's really important. I mean, if the drums aren't there, the record doesn't work. Even if the music works, the record doesn't work. You know, because the drums got to fill up a lot of space, and they got to all be there. Mm-hmm. You got to feel them, you know? And particularly, you know, one thing that's kind of going on within our record company is, you know, I work with the son, the father is the guy that owns the company and makes all the decisions about, you know, what he likes. He's just, it's his company. And he's more fond of using an engineer who uses quote-unquote older recording technique. Okay. But the bottom line is, a lot of these records we put out, my own personal feelings, they don't sound that good. And one of the reasons is, you know, the sonic aspect of the drum. Aspect of it to me, you know, when the saxophone player plays, he plays into one microphone. He's got one instrument, one microphone. Well, the drummer's got 8, 10, 12 instruments. You know, and if you want them to be balanced, if you want them to be present, then they should each have their own microphone. Mm-hmm. You know? Otherwise, it's just all like a distant thing where everything's equal. You know, the snare is equal to the tom, and there's nothing. I mean, that's not the way it's played. And I don't know what the difference is because, you know, it's a funny thing because these people think, well, this is the way they used to record it. You know, very simple terms. But they don't have the sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, because those records, in fact, I was talking with Chico not too long ago about, you know, the Hot 5 recording. And I think the Hot 7 was when they first. You know, the guy was using more than a block of wood. And that stuff is there.
Oh, and it's so
and it sounds great.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. It was in the Baby Dawes, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just.
And it's a funny thing, you know, somewhere, some kind of way, in this concept of trying to keep it pure, something has happened in terms of. Yeah, but I guess what it boils down to is the engineers don't have the talent and don't have the ears that they used to.
I was going to talk to you about that. I've noticed listening to older recordings where it sounded more, I don't know if it was alive or what, but it sounded different. You could hear everything going on in the session. And I mean, they had primitive equipment back then. Even Rudy Van Gelder recording in his living room. My God, the sound was, I thought was great. But even go back further than that, Muggsy Spanier's recordings, even, you know, a lot of the old stuff. And man, you could listen to that forever. It just, and I think also where they probably destroyed it was transferring it to the CD technology. You listen to Jelly Roll Morton's older stuff, and the mess they've done on CD is, it's awful.
Yeah.
Sacrilegious. I don't know if you agree with that, but.
I haven't listened to it. I haven't heard it. Jelly Roll Morton. I haven't.
Well, a lot of, particularly with the jazz, I mean, one thing, and Chico's very good about this, is not to be scared of the technology. I mean, the studio we recorded the Trio album in, it's probably one of the most technologically advanced studios in New York. Very lucky to be able to get it, because it's rather expensive. And you know, and it's kind of another aspect of the contradiction about what I was talking about before, because it, first of all, I don't think that per se a record, jazz record that you make in 1993 should have the same sound as a jazz record made 40 years ago, because, you know, that's not the way people hear anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, it's a weird take on things, but I think people have to be more willing to utilize the technology, particularly with the digital aspect of it.
Right.
Because you get in a good digital studio, and you're going to be able to hear everything, because there's a 1,000 feet of headroom and there's no noise.
Yeah. It's funny, because you think of labels like Manfred Eicher's ECM, or Giovanni, what's the last name?
Bonandrini's
Soul Note and Black Saint. They have distinctive sounds. I don't know, like you listen to an ECM recording, it's clean.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Mm-hmm. Same thing with any Black Saint or Soul Note.
Mm-hmm.
And the music, for the most part, is great. You know, listen to Leroy Jenkins on Soul Note and Black Saint.
Right.
Great music.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
And that's another thing, you know, with the American labels now, they have no sound. I mean, you know, it's still possible that somebody might go into a record store, as a for instance, and see an artist who they've never heard of, and buy it because it's on ECM, or buy it because it's on Blackstone. But nobody gives a shit if something's on Polydor or Burr. Nobody. I mean,
there's not that enthusiasm or something.
It's less than zero to the median. It doesn't. It's not just zero. It's less than zero.
Because I know, like, I wasn't born then, but I guess back in the 40s when you went to buy a Commodore recording, hey man, that was a big thing. Like, you had, you know, really good artists on there, and sound was good, and there was a lot of care taken, and, you know, Milt did a pretty good job. And did you ever listen to any old Commodore recordings, Chico?
Well, whoever was on there, you know, whoever was on, you know, if, I'm just trying to remember who they recorded, I mean, who was on the right. If they did Lunsford or Basie, you know, hey, no, that was Decca. I think they were Decca, right?
Yeah, that was Decca.
Yeah. I listened to Duke, Basie, Jimmy Lunsford, you know, and Benny Goodman, and Earl Hines, and who knows? Oh, and I heard when the Ella Fitzgerald came, Chick Webb with the, you know, that band. And those were the bands, you know.
It was exciting, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there was, you know, it was unbelievable. But then when they started to, you know, small group things, that was, yeah. It became something else, too. But, you know, during that period, you had to be, in order to record, man, you had to almost be at the peak of your profession. You had to have the arrangement or the song or whatever you're going to do had to be down, you know, and before they would even allow you to record, you know, before a record company would even consider recording you, you know. So, virtually, in a sense, during that period, there was never any bad records. You might not have liked some of the songs, but there was never any bad performance, never a bad...
It's a lot of discipline.
Tremendous amount. You had to have a tremendous amount of discipline.
Did you ever play the Apollo in Ireland?
Not in the golden years.
No.
Not in the golden years of the Apollo, no. No,
the audiences were tough there.
They wouldn't play me. I wasn't playing the kind of music that at the time, you know, at least when my first quintet, that wasn't the kind of music that the Apollo was buying. They ain't gonna buy no cello and flute, all that shit. It was a different thing. But I have played the Apollo.
Yeah. So what are you going to be doing now after the Ottawa Festival? Do you have any other festivals that you're going to be playing at, or?
Not up here. We're going to be doing, we got a thing at Lincoln Center next month, which is an out-of-doors festival, which he could be playing by himself, a seminar kind of thing, for the general public, which is up in the middle of August. I think we'll probably be back up here next year to do Montreal.
Yeah.
We'll see what else happens. Mm-hmm. No, the things we do, we're a little selective. You know, just to go somewhere to play. You know, I mean, to come up here and entertain the people there, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure for us to be able to do it. And, you know, if you do that 7 nights a week forever, at times, it's not a pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're a little bit, you know, I think people sometimes are surprised by the degree to which we're selected. Another thing is we refuse to work for free, which is a big problem right now. All the economic difficulties and the position in the media and the marketplace, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, at this stage, for him, I don't see any reason to have to put him through that.
Yeah.
You know, we do what we want to do.
Do you still do a lot of drum workshops occasionally?
Occasionally. I teach a class called Analysis of the Rhythm at the Parsons. School of Design down in New York.
Oh, yeah.
And it's become very rewarding because the people that have developed out of that class, out of those classes, are going to eventually become very good musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the good part.
They even become famous.
Yep.
Well, I think of some of the people in your band, the sax player, Eric.
The ones in there now?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Eric Preston. Yeah,
he's got his own.
He's destined.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kerry. Yeah, they, you know.
Yeah, the guitarist. He's different sound.
Yeah.
I just can't get over that sound. I don't think I've ever really heard that kind of sound before. I don't know, it just struck me. When
you haven't heard it in the jazz vein. A jazz concept, of, you know. You've heard that sound maybe in rock and roll, or,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But you never heard it in a, you know,
yeah.
Different context.
And I mean, even after listening to Kenny Burrell or, you know, Barney Kess or any of those.
Oh, well, those guys are straight ahead. He's a different kind of player completely.
Yeah.
You know what Kenny's going to play, and you know what Barney's going to play.
Yeah.
You know, he plays two bars, and you know you can whistle the other two.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But you're not. You know, what the hell Kerry's gonna play?
are there any situations that you haven't played in yet? I mean,
how do you mean?
Well, you've done orchestras, you've done trios, but are there any mix and match sort of things with classical musicians or?
No, I don't know. I'm just it's all, you know. First of all, it's all music.
Yeah.
And as a side man, I recorded with Chet Atkins. I've done country. I've done it all, man. It's, you know, man. I did an album for Impulse, man, with Pete. What was the Planet player?
Huh?
No, Pete. All those Dixieland guys, Bob Haggard, oh man. Yeah, well, anyway, all these guys.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah, all these, you know, reputable Dixieland guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And
Ralph Sutton?
No, oh no. These I'm way before these. I'm talking about these guys were, you know, the backbone of, you know. Anyway, I did an album with them, my rhythm section, and we played. It was Willie Bobo, myself, and Potato, and I think Stinson. Yeah, I think it was Stinson. That's with the rhythm section, right?
Mm-hmm.
I played Latin rhythm. We played Latin rhythm behind Dixieland, man. It was it worked.
Is that available, or is that out of print? I don't
know. It might be out of print.
Yeah.
Bobby Hackett.
Yeah.
Bobby Hackett and Yank Lawson.
Part of the world's greatest jazz band.
Yeah, Yank Lawson and Pee Wee Russell.
Oh, Pee Wee.
Pee Wee Russell?
Wow.
Yeah. That's who was it. Pee Wee Russell, right.
Wow.
You know?
What year was this?
I don't know, man. It was either in the 60s. Yeah. Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff out there that I'd love to hear again that hasn't been available for years.
Now, this was very successful. I mean, this was it was different. It was really different.
Do you remember the tunes you played on it?
We played the standard
repertoire.
Yeah, the Dixieland repertoire, you know, tunes.
That's all they need, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, getting back to drummers, another one that I really enjoyed was Saeed Fraser. Remember, speaking about Dixieland, he played with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
I don't think I ever heard those guys, but you know,
yeah.
You know, just read about them or something like that, but I never.
Yeah, the first time I saw him, just totally blew me away. Again, a different way of playing, you know.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't the same old thing, just different. And you learn a lot, you know. I don't know if you agree with this, but one advice I tell people is that by listening to music, you can learn like a lot about life. you know, about how to deal with relationships.
That's what life is all about.
Yeah.
Life is, you know, it's just one course after another. You know. That's what it is. Life is music. Music is life, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember
people, you know, guys, people play themselves, man. Yeah.
That's true, eh?
They play themselves, man. Play, you know, they play exactly how they feel. You know?
Yeah.
You can tell a lot about a person the way he, by the way he plays.
Mm.
You know?
Like Dizzy, for instance, when you listen to him play.
Yeah.
I mean, that's we seem to be losing all the good ones lately. You know, but his playing, there's...
Well, you know, Dizzy was a very fortunate man.
Yeah.
Then to be 75 years old, man, played his horn all the way.
Oh,
and the accolades that he got, and the rewards that he received, he was blessed, man. He had a... he's blessed,
yeah.
You know? How many people can say that? There's a lot of people in this world, in and out of this world, right?
Yeah. Another one I can think of might be Cab Calloway, who's still playing.
Cab is still, you know, he's still on the scene, right?
Lionel Hampton, yeah, he's still.
Lion Gates, he's something else. That's something. That's.
I tell you
who was sort of amazing to me was Benny Goodman, and the reason why I say that is because knowing how difficult and how much air it took to play the clarinet, and man, he's blowing his ass off. Till the day he got out of here, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that's...
Same thing with Earl. I mean, Earl died, what, the day after he played a club in L.A. or something?
Who?
Earl Hines.
Oh.
Like, I mean, he was just...
Well, that's different. Playing a keyboard, playing a piano, as opposed to having to put breath in a horn. You know, you understand what I'm saying? And, like Benny Carter, man. He's 80 some odd years old, man, and he's still got a sound.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
That's you know, that's the incredible thing about people who still play, you know.
Oh.
Especially when they breath blowing, you know, that you got to use your energy, your breath. That's, you say, God damn.
Yeah, how do they do it?
It's amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Or as an instrument that you play with your hands, I mean, you know, you don't have to put any use.
Yeah.
Hey, you can play forever, you know, that kind of thing. You know, as long as you're able to lift a finger, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then putting air in a horn.
Well, I'll tell you, I remember a few years ago, this is hard to talk about, but I saw Pepper Adams at a club in Montreal, and that was the last show he did. And he played for over 3 hours with lung cancer. And the guy was just blowing.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the younger guys can't even keep up to him for 3 hours. And then he collapsed and, you know, a couple of months later he was gone. But I mean, to be able to do that, it was just, man, just knocked me out. And when you have the will or something that keeps you going, I don't know, it's just... I guess it's a love for life too, you know, just playing that.
Well, you know, you do what you do.
Mm.
And that's what you do, you do what you do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Chico.
Hey, listen, your pleasure, my pleasure.
It's great.
It's not a dynamite, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah.